Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
What's the date today? Okay. So 13th of December, 2015. I'm Mark Perez. And the reason I'm doing this is so we can calibrate the date on the recording. I think we're calibrated now. Okay, so good morning to everybody. What we're going to be talking about this morning is a recapitulation of what I worked on a few months ago. If you remember, no, even if you don't remember, in September I was here and I did a presentation on logical fallacies. And the reason for that was that I had had some people ask me about that because I was teaching a critical thinking class and some of the students were in this class. I said, well, why don't you talk about that here? So I decided, well, let's just do that. So now we're 4 months later. And something tells me that probably everyone here doesn't have a perfect memory. So we're going to go through some of it again. And I've added a little bit to it. Some videos that weren't in there last time. And then we're going to talk a little bit about how we apply this. So let's start about why we should even care about this. I've taught critical thinking in the university setting. I've taught it in an occupational setting where I've taught executives about critical thinking, problem solving. And I've had people ask me, is there any way to teach critical thinking in other domains? I had a nurse who's had a PhD in nursing, and she governed a lot of nurses. And she said, we have some new nurses, and they really need a dose of critical thinking. And then some other people in other disciplines likewise said, well, can you apply it here? Can you apply it there? And I said, well, you can apply it anywhere. So something popped into my mind, which was, why is it that we find a need to learn how to think critically? Where does that come from? And so I thought, maybe we could talk about that first before we get into anything else. What is it about our upbringing, our schooling, our training, our culture, our whatever, that inhibits our critical thinking? Jamie?
I think we're taught what to think and not how to think.
We're taught what to think and not how to think. Thank you. Go ahead.
Attorney's mind.
Attorney's mind?
Might. Hinder our critical thinking.
Okay, we apologize to any attorneys in this room. No attorneys were injured in the production of this film. Okay, keep on going. Why would attorneys...
Well, because, you know, you could be a witness on the stand, you could just be observing it, and they're trying to give a testimony, but then... there's somebody who's apparently trying to twist the testimony by tricky questions or, you know, leading phrases, and it makes us wonder about, you know, the profession.
Something tells me you sat on a jury. Were you a juror?
Yeah.
Okay, so another victim of the jury system in the room is wondering, why is it that attorneys would wish we wouldn't have critical thinking? That's an interesting question, particularly in courtrooms, because what is a courtroom trying to do? Well, what a courtroom is trying to do is to constrain evidence so that only admissible evidence gets in, and the admissible evidence is decided way in advance by rules of court, by evidence rules, by laws. But the judge also has to determine what's admissible, because he's the determiner of the law. So if someone says, well, I want to admit this evidence, the judge has to see, does this comply with the law? And so are there things that could be relevant that don't get seen by the jury?
Yes.
Sure. Sure there are. So the judge gets to exclude it if the judge believes that it doesn't comply with the law. But sometimes that's a completely discretionary act. Because judges can't be punished for what they do on the bench. They cannot. They're immune. It's built into the law. So if they botch a case really badly, can't sue the judge, nothing can happen. So what does that have to do with critical thinking? Well, it has exactly to do this. That if there is a reason to be taught to think errantly, are you likely to be taught and think errantly? Yes. Yes. What other ways are the information that come to us altered in a way that affects our thinking? Please, Colleen.
By our own biases.
Can you give me an example of a bias somebody might have that would filter the way they think?
I don't like people with black shirts.
Casey doesn't like people with black shirts. So, I don't blame him. I wouldn't listen to anybody like that either. By the way, this almost became a white shirt as I was eating those little things over there with the powder on them. Ross Hoagland saw the mess, which I did not see because I only dropped it and he got to see it. And he says, is that some kind of shirt with stars on it? You know, I said, no. Please, go ahead.
The son of the person for whom I am named had a bias towards putting his father's stuff on DVD. But I got around that. I got him from Latin America.
Oh, I got you. Well, thank you for that example. I appreciate that. Okay, where else do we acquire our ways of thinking? Please.
Worldview.
Okay, what is a worldview? What do you mean by that?
Well, that's your way of interpreting the reality around you.
Good.
And so, like, say, if I were raised as a terrorist, an Islamic terrorist, I would have a totally different way of looking at a disaster than someone who was raised in a Christian upbringing, raised in Christian upbringing.
Thank you. So let's take that up a little bit. If I have a worldview that's endowed by my upbringing, do I understand that is what you mean? What ways of thinking? Can you think of some things that I might have and I might believe in one worldview that I might not believe in another? Or let me stretch that out a little bit. In what way might I think differently in one worldview than another? You think of a way?
Look at disasters.
Okay. One thing is how people look at disasters. What else?
I suppose if you have a materialistic worldview, you're not going to let anything in. You're not even going to countenance any arguments, or you may not even countenance any arguments that anything to do outside of that.
Thank you. So what Jamie says is if I'm a materialist, then I don't countenance any possibility that there's something outside of a material world that could influence the material world. That very strictly affects your reasoning. Yes, please.
And also living under dictatorship, because they're forced to believe that taking a particular way, otherwise they're afraid for their lives.
Good, thank you. Carol.
What do you believe about the origins of humanity in the world?
And how would those influence your reasoning?
Versus creation, versus God, versus atheism and evolution.
Okay, so those would be different points of view that you would either adopt or reject. Thank you. Somebody have... Yes, sir.
I think critical thinking has to embody skepticism, too. If somebody comes up to you and says, I saw a guy walk on water, and you didn't see it, you have to be skeptical. You have to ask yourself, is this guy delusional? Did it happen? Really happen? But you didn't see it, so you have to be kind of skeptical about it.
Yeah, skepticism is an important part of critical thinking. And it's when I was when I taught my first class of critical thinking at a university, I was trying to think, how am I going to get these very young people to listen? Because they are not in this class because they want to be. It's on a schedule of courses. They're stuck. They're going like this with their arms folded, waiting for you to be done so they can go to Starbucks. Okay, so that's the reality. So I'm trying to figure out, how do I make this interesting to a group of people who absolutely don't want to hear what I have to say? And this is going to the point that I was getting at when I asked the question, what is it that causes us to believe or to reason a particular way? And so one of the things I told the students is when I when I opened the class was, do you realize there are people right now who control your mind? They don't want to hear that. They want to hear that they're in control of their own mind. No, there's no. Who's in control of my mind? Are you saying there's some kind of robot with a beam sucking my brain out of my head and replacing it with something else? So, well, not too far away from it.
No, it's here.
It's there. So it's usually on a screen, and it could be a really big one, or it could be a little one. But there is some kind of beam going somewhere, and it's going to your head, and it is changing the way you think.
Satan is controlling the minds of people.
Satan does too. So, the students are thinking, okay, I think he means television, movies, videos, and now the light bulb is finally turning on. And so I tell them, all right, what about if they're the ones controlling the way you're thinking and you don't, or I'm saying that they're controlling your thinking and you don't believe it? Let's test it. Is it possible that your mind is being controlled and you don't even know it? Now they're starting to get worried. Because the guy in front of the classroom is kind of coming up with a conspiracy theory, and how are you going to disprove this conspiracy theory? So I asked them, tell me the last thing that you bought based on an advertisement. And people think about it, and then they tell me whatever it is. And I said, before you saw the advertisement, or any advertisement for that, how eager were you to buy that? And then it's as if I could watch all the light bulbs pop on in their heads. They're realizing, oh, advertising has an effect on me. I didn't even know I wanted one of those until I saw it on TV, or in a movie, or in a video. And so it goes with all sorts of different things. When we grow up, we learn from our parents certain kinds of things. So I learned from my parents, for example, that people who were religious were stupid. That was what I was taught. I was raised to be an atheist. So I would say, well, okay. I don't much care. I'm a little kid. I don't care. I don't know. I know anything about it. But what was subtle there was I was being taught to not question it. Now, Al says part of being a critical thinker is being skeptical. Absolutely right. If we don't ask questions or question what it is that's being presented to us in some way, sometimes we can take at face value what it is. We trust the source, etc. But at some point, when an argument is posed, we have to be able to ask some questions to determine whether the argument is sound, which means the conclusion is either strong, because it's inductive, or it's true, or it's valid, or all of them. Now, if it's inductive, it's only going to be strong. If it's deductive, it has to be valid. And if it's deductive and true, then the conclusion has to be true. That makes it a sound argument. So I don't want to push that too far, because you'll throw me out saying you've got too many definitions going on here.
Well, can I say something?
Okay, before you do, there was somebody in the back who had his hand up. Yes, sir.
Go back to the advertising.
Yes, please.
You're more apt to buy something if it's on a page in full color than something in black and white. Color sells.
Interesting. Thank you.
Yes. I used to be a printer, so.
Okay. Go ahead, Steve.
It'll be 15 years ago on Christmas Eve. That was in the year 2000. That first step through the doors of this church. And there was a cult trying to control my mind. And I had to ask God to free me from those people.
It worked, didn't it?
Yes.
Praise God for that. Thank you for telling us that. I'm glad nobody else is controlling your mind now but the Holy Spirit.
Right.
Amen. Please.
You were talking about critical thinking, what we're taught and whatnot. In schools today, a large percentage of critical thinking assignments are multiple choice.
Well, I can't fault the teacher, because it's not easy to grade essays and stuff like
what
that.
What I'm saying is they try to emphasize it, but they're going down the wrong path. Kids can't critically analyze stuff for the most part.
Well, there are ways of doing multiple choice for that, though. I mean, I understand what you're getting at. the narrative is the most beautiful way of expressing something. And it's also the most difficult way of trying to help somebody. Try taking a two-page essay from somebody that's a disaster and then explaining to them how they need to think well. If you have a head full of hair, when you're done, you'll go bald. Because you'll rip your hair out of your head trying to do that. I got proof right here. Okay. So, where are we going next here? We all have parents that have taught us how to think. Let's think of some things that we were taught that we know today were wrong. Well, if that kind of people says it, it's not right. Okay? So my father taught me, if religious people say it, it's probably false. But he taught me to think that without ever questioning him. If we hear that a large number of people believe something, are we more or less likely to believe the same thing? More likely. But is the number of people who believe it the determinant of whether it's true?
No,
it isn't. But as we grow up, how do we get taught to socialize? Everybody else is doing it. You just step in line and get on with it. Be one of us. Is that a bad thing? Not necessarily. How else are we supposed to have a society? But could it be a bad thing? Of course it could be. There's all sorts of interesting examples of that. Remember when the space shuttle went up and blew up? The first one? And there was what was wrong with it?
O-ring.
O-ring. And what was wrong with the thinking process that led to the destructive O-ring remaining on that at takeoff? Do you know the story behind that? Okay, it was not supposed to be used at that temperature. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so here's what went on. There was, and this is a great example of critical thinking as well as a great example of what I'm talking to you about here in terms of how groups operate. Because we're taught to do what with groups? We're taught to assimilate with them, to not fight with them. Some interesting experiments on that, by the way. Really interesting experiments. So what happens here, a long story, very short. One of the engineers says, hey, you know what? We predict a certain temperature on takeoff. We don't think this O-ring is ready for that. Our tests showed that temperature and above, or above that temperature. We think that may freeze, and if that goes south, the whole thing is going to get a hole through it, and it's going to blow up, and it's going to be a mess. So that was presented to some other people in the food chain, and the food chain says, well, I don't know. You know, we got a schedule to take care of here. And so it went in front of a group. What happened to the group? The group got what they call groupthink. They all said, well, you know, there's nothing saying we can't do it, so why don't we just go ahead and do it? Very short story. This is simplistic. It's much more complicated than this. So they take off, and it does exactly what the engineer who said it's probably going to fail said it was going to happen. But the group didn't want to argue about it. They all wanted to take off, and so they suppressed that, and the result was really, really obvious. A lack of critical thinking, it's a very particular kind of cognitive bias. Very particular kind of cognitive bias. Here's the results of one of the experiments that was conducted on this. Group of people who were invited to come and do an assessment. And what they were assessing was whether two objects were the same size or one was bigger than the other. And it was obvious. I mean, you could look at them. So nobody was denying. There was no trickery. Except for this, that most of the people who were going in and doing the lining up were experimenters. They weren't people just off the street. And so they have three or four experimenters who were plants. And so they'd be in a long line, and then the person would come out from behind the shield and would be asked, okay, which one of these objects is bigger, A or B? These seven people in front of you, by the way, all said B, but you can say whatever you want to say. One right after the other, after the other, after the other. and it got to, I don't know, 15 or 20 people, and I don't know how many different groups they did this through. What do you think the results were? Almost every group, there's either unanimity or very close to unanimity. In other words, the people who showed up, who could see, well, this thing is really obviously bigger than that other thing. These other people all saying it's not. They just, once they found out what the group was saying, they did it even though it was objectively false. Fascinating how our minds work. But that's not because they have a warped mind. That isn't because they couldn't see or that being told that suddenly changed the way they could see it. It was their behavior and their willingness to do this. It was a cognitive bias toward wanting to assimilate with the group. So this is one of a large number of things that we have to deal with when we're dealing with why we reason the way we do and whether we should reason other ways. Yes, sir, in the back.
What is that, what you were just talking about, the groups coming up with their own opinions, imply for juries, for example?
Oh, it's terrible. The implications are terrible. Okay. Because there's the same kind of group think and desire for affiliation in juries, too. I think there was a movie about that. Mm-hmm. Was it 12 Angry Men or something like that? Was that it? Am I on the right track there? Yeah. The movie was fictional, but the effect was real. Yeah, it's very scary. The only problem with the jury system is what's the replacement? That's the problem. But we can get into that in another day. So what we're going to do today is we're going to be looking at some fallacies of arguments, but first we're going to try and figure out what do we mean by an argument. So when you hear the word argument, you often think of the term as something that's implying combat. Okay, I had an argument with my wife. Well, what does that mean? That she and I shared a set of premises and a conclusion? Probably not. Probably not. So we didn't see eye to eye. No, and wouldn't have been this, because if I were there and this was my wife, I wouldn't be talking. Yeah, I'd go for a walk. So what is an argument? We know that one of the ways of using the term argument is a fight or dispute or something like that. But that isn't really what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is something a little bit more precise. And it's a claim supported by reasons and evidence. So a claim is making a statement about something. So I say, Ross is wearing a blue shirt. Well, my reasons for saying that. Well, I can see it. And the evidence is that if everybody looks at it, you can see it's one color instead of another, and it happens to be blue. Okay, so that's my evidence. So that's all we're talking about. We're talking about reasons, evidence, and a claim. There's another way of looking at it, too, and this jump rope is just not working for me today. And I'm going to see if this video works. So give me some little bit less light here. We're going to try this out.
Claims are not just opinions. A claim tells what you think is true about a topic based on your knowledge and your research. If you're ever going to convince your mom to get that new cell phone that's just perfect for you, you're going to have to move beyond mere opinion. You're going to need to support your claim to get rid of that crummy, old, obsolete phone that's holding you back. But there are two sides to every argument. In your argument for a new cell phone, your mom stands on the other side. She has something to say against your claim that you need a new cell phone, and it goes something like, "No, you don't." That's your mom's counterclaim. A counterclaim is just the opposite of a claim. In a more formal way, she might say, "Your current situation does not require a new cell phone." Counterclaims are also provable and supportable by reasons and evidence, not just because I said so. When you're planning an argument, you need to know what the counterclaim might be so that you can make sure that you disprove it with your reasons and evidence. After your mom's counterclaim, she'll probably ask, "Why is it that you think you need a new cell phone?" Then it's time for the reasons. You prepared well in advance because you know exactly what she'll ask. "My cell phone doesn't have internet access." That's a reason. A reason tells why. A reason makes someone care and tells the importance of the claim and of the argument.
Lights, please.
Who was that?
I forget her name. But she was on the video, not here. Let me mention a couple of things here. First of all, when she was talking about the elements of an argument, including a counterclaim, that isn't necessarily true. Because I can propose an argument and nobody disputes it. They just say, "Oh, that's a great argument. Mark Perez is standing in front of you. Who's going to argue with that?" Well, Al might, because he's a skeptic. So how do I really know you're in front of me, Mark? You might be somewhere else, and this is just a giant smoke and mirror routine. But let's look at an argument that actually does have some counterclaims to it, or at least one counterclaim. I will argue that God exists, and what would be the counterclaim to the argument that God exists? What is it? God does not exist, right. So that's the most simplistic way of looking at it. It's just the negation of the claim. Really, a counterclaim is a little bit different. It can say, well, maybe God exists and maybe we don't know he exists. Or it could be something like that. But the bottom line is there a counterclaim can be made and we have to be prepared for it. And that's what her point is. There will be another video that I'll show you where there's a little bit more preparation. And it's really a cute little video. But where I want to go with this is, do we understand what we mean by reasons? She said reasons are the what?
Why.
Say it again?
The why.
The why, yes. So why should I care? Why does it matter? That's her explanation for reasons. One of the important things to understand about critical thinking, and when you look it up in the Wikipedia or an encyclopedia, or you read about it somewhere, is that there are different definitions. There isn't just one set of standard definitions for all of the terms. So as I'm going through them, I'm going to be giving you the ones that are most often seen. And by most often, I mean maybe 90%. Could there be other people using other terms? Yes, they can. I was doing a video with Ken Samples, and he and I were talking, and he was using the word claim in a way I wasn't using it. So he and I were both trained as philosophers, and yet we both were schooled using the term differently. So my point here is that part of what we do when we're critically thinking is we define our terms, which is why I'm going into depth here. And what are we talking about? We're asking about reasons and claims and counterclaims, etc. We know exactly how they operate. We know exactly what they mean when we use the term. Does it mean nobody else can use the term another way? No, they can use it any way they want, as long as they define it. Or, if they refuse to define it, or don't define it, I shouldn't say refuse. If they neglect to define it, whose job is it to define it? your job to at least ask, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by that particular word? One of the things I could have asked when I was a child, my dad was telling me that religious people were stupid, was why? Now, I asked why about a whole lot of things, but I did not ask why about that. I just assumed it was true. Dad said it. I know. His belt is way bigger than my butt, so it must be true.
I thought it was brainwashed. It was brainwashed. Like something else.
Could be that too, yeah. But my dad did have a good belt. So I was really, really good at being accurate at what he said and reciting what he said and learning what he said. So that there's an argument for that. There's actually a fallacy that, you know, it's called ad baculum. It's an appeal to force. In fact, there's actually a term for that. If I can hurt you or make something unpleasant for you to cause you to believe something, that's called an ad baculum argument. And that's a fallacy. And I think you can figure out why. Somebody had a hand up. Yes, please. No, deductive reasoning. The question was, is there a difference between critical thinking and deductive reasoning? The answer is no. The proper answer to that is that deductive reasoning is one of the ways of thinking critically. So critical thinking includes deductive reasoning, inductive reasoning, abductive reasoning, all three kinds. Thank you. The best way to learn how to use critical thinking is to watch it in action. I have a very grainy video I'm going to watch you and or show you, and it only lasts a couple of minutes. But despite the graininess of it, what I'd like you to do is pay very close attention to what Greg Kokel is going to say, and then at the end he's going to make a mention of Christopher Hitchens' argument or an interruption that he makes, and then we're going to talk about that. Because this is a real-world example, and there's nothing better than watching it happen to learn how to deal with it.
Explicitly now, an argument is something very particular, and it isn't just an opinion. If you say there is no God, that's not an argument. That's a point of view. It might be a conclusion if you have reasons that led you to that point. Think of an argument like a house. House has got a roof, and it's got walls that support the roof. If the walls are strong and sturdy, then the roof is supported. If they are not, the roof falls down. An argument is like that. The roof would be the point of view. There is no God. Now, what supports that conclusion? That is, what is the evidence, what are the reasons, whatever. What are the walls? The walls are the supporting evidences, what make up the argument. And in any given argument, you have to figure out what those two things are. The point of view, what do you mean by that? Remember that from earlier today? And the reasons for the point of view, how did you come to that conclusion? So whenever you encounter a challenge, you can break the challenge down, whether it comes in a book or whether it comes on a TV show or just somebody having a conversation with you, you break it down and you try to focus in on exactly what is the person claiming to be so and what precisely are their reasons that they believe it is so. Once you get the argument in front of you, then you can look at it. Christians hear a person like Christopher Hitchens and he goes on and rattles and this and that and the other thing and they get really nervous and upset and scared. So don't be scared. Just listen to what he says. No, but you might have to get a tape recorder. You might have to outline his book or something. It might take a while to separate the wheat from the chaff, the nonsense from the real argument. Get the real argument in front of you, though. And when you do, then you'll have an opportunity to examine it. So clear the brush, then ask about the house. What is the argument? What are the reasons for the point of view?
He said it was Christians who, when they hear Christopher Hitchens, they get intimidated and scared by him. I heard this, I had to hear that three times before I understood that word. He was saying Christian, so if the rest of you got it, you have really, really good hearing.
Okay.
Now, Christopher Hitchens, a month or so ago, debated a friend of mine, J. Wesley Richards. He wrote the book The Privileged Planet, which is and there's a DVD that goes with it. It's a very, very powerful argument for the existence of God based on cosmology, design. It's superb. It's the best thing going. If you want one single thing, you get this DVD, you just pop it into your television, and you push the button, and you have your friend just sit down and just watch it, and then talk with them about it later. It's really sensational. Anyway, so here's Jay Richards, who is the Christian theist, and there's Christopher Hitchens. And Hitchens gets up first, and Hitchens does his number with all his nonsense and his ideas, and he's throwing all this stuff up. But Jay has his turn. He's starting to talk, and then he's talking for a little while, and then Hitchens interrupts him. And Hitchens makes this point. I think we have a slide for this. Hitchens says, "Do you believe that Jesus Christ was born of a virgin? Do you believe that he resurrected from the dead?" Now he's interrupted, my friend, Jay Richards. So Jay, all right, stops and he says, "Well, yeah, I do believe in the virgin birth and I do believe in the resurrection." And Hitchens says, "I rest my case." He's sitting there. "I rest my case. This is an honest guy who has just made it very clear that science has nothing to do with his worldview." Now this is rhetorically powerful. It's clever. But here's my question. You just said you rested your case. What case would that be?
Mark, are we going to see Hitchens' side?
Oh, absolutely not. This is critical thinking. We don't listen to the other person's viewpoint. We're going to use the same rhetorical devices that Christopher Hitchens uses, which is to completely blast the other person with nonsense, and then when the other person is talking, you interrupt them. And so you distort their message by interruption. So the reason I wanted to show this video, and it was short enough so it didn't occupy all our time, but was to give you an insight into how somebody else looks at what an argument is. He was describing an argument as what? A claim, which was the what? The roof of the house, and then what was the support?
The walls.
Okay. And what did he refer to as the support? What was supporting it?
Evidence.
Evidence, yeah. So you have evidence supporting the roof, which is the claim. Then he went on to talk about a very useful rhetorical device to overcome that. And he used Christopher Hitchens as the example. What is the lesson here? The lesson here is that critical thinking is not just getting to the logic and getting to an understanding of what kind of argument you're using, but that critical thinking means you have to step back and comprehend all of what's going on in a particular discourse, including interruptions, including little side games, including a whole lot of stuff. So we have here on the screen something that talks about three elements of a whole theology. And I'm using that to compare with the elements of a whole discourse because there are some remarkable similarities. So, up here it says, the elements of a whole theology, and the first thing it says is orthodoxy. What is orthodoxy?
Right teaching.
The right teaching, yes, thank you. John, did you have something different? Okay. How about, so that there's the right teaching, so what's going on in our heads? What's the next one?
Orthopraxy.
What is orthopraxy? Say it again.
The practice.
The correct. Ortho means correct. So orthopraxis is practicing correctly. Doing the right thing.
Right doing.
The right doing. Well said. Thank you. What is... looks like a doctor, huh? Yeah. I'm an orthopathist. No. I'm not an orthopathist. This is orthopathy, which is not like neuropathy or any other kind of pathy. What is orthopathy? Or... What does it sound like to you?
Feeling,
yes, thank you. Orthopathy is the right sentiments. So, for example, I could have the right beliefs, but not do anything about it and not care about it. So I don't care about anybody. Is that an orthopraxy? Excuse me, orthopathy? I don't care. Do I care? If I don't care, is that what the Bible says is a correct theology? I don't. Am I supposed to do what with people? Starts with L and ends with of.
Love.
Love, yes, good.
Emotions.
Good. So orthopathy includes loving people and doing the other things that you have these feelings for properly. Orthopraxy, if I know it, if I have the right orthodoxy, I've got the Bible down and memorized, now how do I practice it? Do I just sit in my chair and meditate on my navel and think, oh, I know all there is about the Bible and do nothing? Orthopraxy is what are you doing with your orthodoxy?
And,
thank you. So let's look at one of the elements of a whole discourse. Logos, ethos, and pathos. Very similar to orthopraxy, orthodoxy, orthopraxy, and orthopathy. We see pathos here, we see pathy here. We don't see ethos here, and we don't see doxy here, but I'll show you what the similarities are after we see the video, and maybe you'll be able to tell me. So yet another video, friends. Let's see what we get out of this one.
Aristotle wrote one of the first great treatises on rhetoric, aptly titled Rhetoric. This treatise was written in the 4th century BCE, and it outlines the three main rhetorical appeals, logos, pathos, and ethos. These three persuasive strategies make up the rhetorical triangle. Aristotle himself did not use the image of a triangle, but he did outline the effective uses of these three modes of persuasion. Think of the triangle as a tortilla chip on a plate of nachos. Sometimes you get a chip with a little of everything on it, cheese, meat, and guacamole. Some of the chips have only meat and cheese, or just cheese and guacamole. Every now and then you enjoy a delicious chip just dipped in the guacamole alone. This is how the rhetorical triangle works. You could form an argument using all three appeals. However, you don't always need to use all three. Sometimes you can make an acceptable argument just using a couple of persuasive techniques, like the chip with meat and cheese. Logos is the meat of an argument. When you are presenting an appeal to logos, you present logic, facts, or truth. It is the message by which you attempt to reason with your audience. Let's call pathos the cheese, because it's the appeal to your audience's emotions. You can move your audience to anger to take action towards war. You can move your audience to fear in order to persuade them to buy a product that prevents illness. Sadness can cause an audience to donate to a cause. Or you can move your audience to believe that certain opinions or actions will make themselves and others happy. As for ethos, you can think of it as the guacamole. Guacamole is good for you, right? Its nutrition credibility is in vitamins E and C. Well, ethos is the speaker or writer's character, credibility, and authority. Ethos attempts to show you that the person or entity communicating is a valid source of information. For example, your teacher's ethos comes from the credibility of their degrees. So, you consider their opinions on particular subjects to be worthy. Nachos can be made in any combination, with more of one ingredient and less of another. Argument works this way as well. You can try out different persuasive recipes in your writing to find the mix that suits your needs and audience. Of course, the strongest arguments are usually built on points that take advantage of logos, pathos, and ethos together. Aristotle thought that logos was the most important of the three, but not all audiences will be persuaded by logos alone. A strong ethos, for instance, may make your audience more receptive to the logos you employ.
Now remember, Greg Kochel was talking about Hitchens using a rhetorical device, something that was very rhetorically powerful. So he said, well, he interrupted, and this is the things he said, and then he said this other thing. Dramatic. It has drama to it. What does that do to the audience? It draws the audience to him. And to what else? To his position. So when Christopher Hitchens interrupts, which of these three things is he using? Logos? Not really. No, and why not? I agree with you. Right, he wasn't positing any facts, he was just making some assertions.
Pathos?
Yeah, he was making a dramatic act. He was trying to be expressive. So you look at him and you're drawn to this expressiveness. That is pathos. Now, ethos, he either has it or doesn't. And ethos really means the character of the person. It's not, this video was for a group that's less sophisticated. And so that's why the chips and stuff like that are used to try and make these. They're pretty good for this class. I mean, given our food propensities and stuff right here. I thought this was really spot on. But you were on it.
Well, you forgot about the jalapenos.
Oh, yeah. We'll have to figure out one of these Greek words for jalapenos. So the elements of a whole discourse are very much like the elements of whole theology. It's the person, the message, and then their love or their ability to engage you. So critical thinking involves all of these things. Now, one of the things, the areas that we're going to go into more than others is this one here. It's logos. So as we go through the rest of the session today, we're going to focus on some of the things that have to do with the logos or the mental or the cognitive part of an argument. So we've learned, what is an argument? It's a claim supported by evidence and reasons. And we found that rhetoric can be a powerful device, and that critical thinking includes rhetoric, as much as I hate to admit that. But all three of these things are involved in arguments. My buddy Aristotle said that. It must be true. The rhetorical triangle. Yeah, the triangle of rhetoric. I forget which way he described it. But like you said, Aristotle never used it. But it's a good way for us to remember it because of the Dorito chips and stuff. Yeah.
Mark?
Yes?
I think you're not going to show us Hitchens?
Not today, but I may do it next week. Yeah.
I'll come.
Well, we'll do it even if you don't come, but you know, you're happy to be here.
I've been watching him debate just about everybody, Muslims. But if you go on YouTube, you can get all these religious debates from all these people that are pretty smart people, all MDs, doctors, and all that stuff.
Sure.
So if anybody wants to
watch it. Does he interrupt all of them?
He doesn't interrupt all of them, but he interrupts enough. And I was looking at one of Hitchens' videos last night, and I was thinking, you know what? That guy is not doing a really good job of arguing anything. He is all about showmanship.
He gets the most applause. You notice that?
Well, that's great. That's really that's the proof an argument's true, is how much applause you get. Right there. That is the core of critical thinking, is that you can determine how well you're thinking by how much applause you get.
Well, is he arrogant?
Or he's arrogant. Yes, sir.
Did you hear Hitchens has become a believer?
Yeah.
Did you hear that?
Yeah, it's all applause.
Yeah, he's dead now.
2 years.
He knows.
2 years.
And
he believes something for sure, and he's not wrong. We know for the first time in his life he is not wrong. Whatever he believes today after he's dead, he's believing because it's real.
Mm-hmm. These are all very sophisticated audiences because they have these debates in the colleges, and he goes to all the Christian colleges all over the place.
What does that mean to you, though, Al?
Out of the safe zone.
What does it mean, though? I mean, let's say you're saying that he's debating sophisticated people. Now the next question is, so what? What does that mean? I mean, I'm trying to help you.
He's giving his point of view as a deist, an atheist.
Yeah.
And and the other guys are giving their point of view. And the audience gets the information that both of them are giving them. So it's very, even, you know, very, very entertaining and instructive to listen to those guys.
It is entertaining for some people, at least half the crowd. And then it is instructive for both sides of the crowd. I find it instructive as someone who teaches critical thinking and who really enjoys good rhetorical debates, because what I see Christopher Hitchin doing is a whole lot of dramatic posing. So he flails his hands around and he hits the table and he makes these interesting kinds of gestures and then changes his voice tone. And then suddenly bursts something out and then everybody's scared. And so it's just like being in a theater where the scene gets quiet and then all of a sudden what happens? Some explosion occurs and everybody's trying to pull themselves off the ceiling, you know, because they're scared and it frightens them. So I look at that and I say, all right, Hitchens, very clever. You're a good man as an advertiser, but you're not going to win anybody to atheism. All you're going to win them is to you. So he will have a following, not because he has good arguments, but because he's entertaining.
Well, he had a book too, Mark.
Oh, then that'll he'll probably sell books.
Yeah, book. Bestseller.
That's more proof that it's true. And the reason we know that is because there's bestsellers on both sides of an issue, so they're both true.
The Bible's a bestseller, and his was also. So
wow.
Take your pick.
That's an interesting fallacy. It's called a weak analogy. Go ahead.
Did you hear that?
Mine's what you pointed out, and I wish my kids were here today. This is an excellent presentation. But if you noticed, we all follow Hugh Ross very closely, but when he goes to these debates, what happens to Hugh? And what's his gift is the fact that he says, I don't realize I'm being criticized or
insulted, sure,
until after the fact. And the fact is Hugh has a really good poker face. And the fact is, and when you're arguing with somebody, if you haven't noticed, if you're making sense, your argument, has continuation to it, and the other person realizes that they are losing ground, what do? They attack, and they pull out emotion, and they distract, and they deflect. And that's what happens to Hugh Ross every time. He's an extremely prepared individual. I mean, he has multi-levels of points to back up his claim. And most people have a shallow argument. They have one or two claims. But then he can dissect those. And they realize it. And next thing you know, they're on the offensive, and they're trying to redirect the argument away from him.
Yes.
It happens to him time and time again.
Thank you. And what's happening there is we're back into rhetoric again. If I cannot respond directly to the supports of your argument, if I can't show that those walls are weak and your argument's going to fail, what do? I regress to rhetoric, and I will use all sorts of interesting distractions. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about informal fallacies. Informal fallacies, in one way or another, are mistakes in reasoning that often don't look like mistakes. Sometimes they're intentional, sometimes they're accidental. Not everybody who uses a fallacious argument is intentionally trying to mislead us. As a matter of fact, the reason that we teach these is that we often use the same fallacies ourselves and don't know it. And it's good for us to know it so that we can be sure that we step back and say, am I reasoning to this conclusion properly? I might have the right conclusion. But if what I'm saying doesn't warrant the conclusion, then nobody has any reason to listen to me. And they really don't have any way to debate me, because there's nothing that I'm saying that makes sense. There's some fallacy. There's a defect in the reasoning. So there's two kinds of fallacies. One of them is formal, and one of them is informal. Now, last time, I had a whiteboard. Evolution occurred in this room, and it grew legs, and it wandered off. So it probably used to be a whale, and now it's something else, and it has legs, and it's somewhere out on those streets, that thing is wandering around, trying to find a home for somebody to ride on it, because it goes for a week without anybody riding on it. It needs that as food.
That's Pinch.
That's Pinch, I know. So, when I had that up here, I did a drawing, and I showed you a formal fallacy, and I said a formal fallacy is a defect in logic per se. In other words, formal logic has a certain set of rules, and if you violate any one of those rules, it is a formal fallacy, because logic is all about form. Logic doesn't care, or there isn't any question about the content of logic, because what is logic? It's a bunch of symbols. It's like mathematics. So when you get into logic, you know, I've been victimized by four different courses in logic, and it's all symbolic logic, and it looks just like math. Matter of fact, some of it's even called sentential calculus, predicate calculus, and all these other things. So when you violate any one of those logical rules, the same thing happens there as happens in mathematics. If you violate the rule, then the conclusion isn't reliable. So that's a formal fallacy. An informal fallacy is an argument where real-world content matters. So in logic, symbolic logic, all we're doing is manipulating symbols and following rules the way we would with mathematics. But in informal reasoning, we care very much about the content of what is said. It's not just the symbol anymore. It's the content. And we'll get more. I'll show you some demonstrations of that in a minute. But the point is that there are two different kinds of fallacies, and we have to be really careful, because sometimes people will say, well, what you just said was illogical, when it might not be illogical at all. Instead, it may be informally fallacious. And we want to be careful. There's a difference between logic and informal reasoning. There is a difference. Informal reasoning sometimes relies on logic, but some of the logic doesn't make sense in informal reasoning. Here's an example. I gave you this example last time, see if you can remember it. What happens in formal logic if you have a claim and then the negation of that claim as premises in an argument? In other words, I say A is premise number one. Not A is premise number two. What can I conclude from that? Anything. Anything. Literally anything. That's called the principle of explosion. It's a formal, logical rule that from a contradiction you can conclude anything. Now you're scratching your head saying, Mark, have you had too much coffee? How in the world do you come up with that? Well, I could write the formula up here on the board and do the logical proof for you. I've seen the logical proofs. I've had to do it in logic class. It works. But it's akin to the arithmetic problem of a square root of a negative number. What do you get? An imaginary number. Yeah. Well, where do you have imaginary numbers? In math. It works. I don't know how it works. It just does. Okay, and the same thing happens with formal logic. There are some things in it that if you try to abstract it into the real world, they just don't make sense. So we don't get too tied up in that. Most of what logic does makes extremely good sense. And you can see when you do the arguments why they work out the way they do. But be careful when you tell somebody what you're saying isn't logical unless you know what the formal logical principle is. Or you know for certain that it is a formal logical principle. Informal fallacies, on the other hand, much, much easier to detect. Let's look at some of these factoids. A fallacy comes from, the word fallacy comes from the 13th century word meaning what?
Deceit.
Deceit, yes. It's an interesting way of originating that word. And it's important to know that not all fallacies have names, because there's no limit to the number of fallacies you can generate in natural language. Interesting concept. There is a limit to the number of fallacies in formal logic, though, because there's a finite set of rules, and Those are the only rules you can violate. In informal reasoning, there's no limit to the number of things you can do with semantics. So this may be a little bit more academic than you wanted to hear about, but I wanted to make sure you understand the scope of what we're talking about when we're dealing with fallacies. And here you see something that says some informal fallacies are logically valid. How can that be? How can it be that something that is defective reasoning informally is perfectly acceptable in logic? Well, I gave you an example of how logic can be perfectly unacceptable to rationality. You know, from a contradiction you can deduce anything. How is it that there's something that works perfectly in logic and doesn't work in informal reasoning? Well, you see a hint there. Circular reasoning, we will go into that and I will show you exactly how that works. Some fallacies overlap. Two or more may apply in the same argument. The reason is that a fallacy description is designed to try to help us understand it and name it and see it. But is it possible you could have two or more that have the same problem? Yes, you could have two or more fallacies that, given that same statement, would apply. So it's important for you to not get too wrapped up and say, well, this is fallacy A, and somebody else says, well, it's fallacy B. Well, it might be both. It can be. So just understand that, because we're not dealing with a one-to-one correspondence, and it's not limited to one-to-one.
It's like there are so-called religious people who claim to be infallible, but they're not.
Exactly. And you know what? It's as if you are seeing exactly where we're going right now. Because on the screen is something that says unqualified expert. Steve, sometimes I know the Lord has put you here for a very deep reason.
Thank you.
And I love you and I'm glad you're here. Yes. Thank you, Steve. So what do we mean by an unqualified expert? Well, when you appeal to an authority in one field for expert opinion outside of their field, that's appealing to an unqualified expert, or an unqualified expert fallacy. So do we have any really good examples of that? Tons of them. Tons of them. They're all over the place. The first place that you're going to find them is in entertainment. So you get movie star X, who's never stepped foot inside a college, who is talking about climate change as if she has a PhD in climatology.
Yeah, Kim Kardashian.
Well, I don't know, did she step foot in a high school? You know, the point is, that was another fallacy, by the way, I just uttered.
You're loaded with them.
I'm loaded with them today. Yeah, you better get out of the way because I might explode. So an unqualified expert is somebody who has no business talking about or making an assertion as an expert in a field that they are actually making the assertion in. So I'm going to give you some examples here on the screen. So Albert Einstein says, peace cannot be kept by force. It can be only achieved by understanding. Now, I have read a biography on Einstein, and I didn't get anywhere in that he had a degree or some kind of mastery on peace studies or
diplomacy
or any of that. But he's a genius. I mean, he was a genius for his time in what he did. So what do people do when they hear this? They think, well, if Einstein said it, it must be true, because the guy's a flaming genius. But he's an unqualified authority. If I were to give a talk and I were to say, we need to quit using so much money on our military because peace cannot be achieved by force, it can be only achieved by understanding, and I were to appeal to Albert Einstein to validate my claim, what would that fallacy be? An appeal to unqualified authority. That's exactly what we're talking about. So Einstein was a true genius. If he thought it was true, it must be true.
Hugh gets accused of that all the time.
of
yes.
being unqualified because he speaks outside of astronomy where his PhD is.
Perfect. So how do we look at Hugh, for example, and there are other people like him who can talk outside of their PhD, but why can they talk outside their PhD?
Because they've had training.
Exactly. Yes, thank you. They've had a great deal of training. There are people in this room who are not astronomers, who are not biologists, who are not a lot of stuff, but who know an awful lot about those other things, enough to be able to make statements and to know when they need to stop. So it's an important thing. Hugh mentions it all the time. He says, oh, he'll go so far, and he says, but stop, I'm not a biologist, I can't go there. So he, to appeal to him for something beyond where he would accept the notion that he's the qualified authority would be an appeal to unqualified authority. But if he says, oh, I've done the study on that, and having a PhD, probably knows how to study. And I know X, Y, and Z, but I don't know A, B, and C. Then an appeal to him and his X, Y, and Z doesn't mean he's correct. It just means we're appealing to an authority that at least is qualified and debatable. Make sense? Ross, please.
I was going to say, couldn't you then also say there's a fallacy of being a qualified expert?
In what regard?
You can't believe somebody just because they're an expert. And Einstein is a good example. He came up with the cosmological constant to do away with the expansion of the universe. There's no one in the world that was more qualified to make that statement, and he was wrong.
Yes, but if your question is appealing to a qualified expert necessarily a guarantee that he's right?
Correct. So that could be a fallacy also.
I'm not so sure it would be a fallacy as it would just be a limited inductive problem. So I can say here I appeal to Hugh Ross on whatever. You know, he tells me the distance between here and the nearest star beyond our sun. Probably isn't going to be anybody who's going to contest that, because that would be rather open and easily understood. But if I were to ask him a question about some of the experiments that were done within the past week, and he were to say, I think this and this, well, he may or may not be right. Is it possible somebody else could be right that could controvert him? Sure. An appeal to authority isn't a guarantee of truth. All it does is give you a belief, a reasonable, justifiable belief in the strength of their position. Not necessarily. You would be. The question is, would I be committing a fallacy if I believed in what he said just because he was an expert? And the answer is not necessarily. Not necessarily, because justifying a belief is different than necessarily having the truth. So he may be true, may not be true, but do we ever have full comprehensive knowledge of anything other than our own sensations?
No. I press my cell phone and it tells me that you have to wrap up.
Oh.
The time on here, he's always been right. I check it against the government website. It always works.
Well, that is a qualified authority, and I accept that. All right. All right, then.
I didn't
have to hear me wrong. Dave, the whole class thinks you're wrong.
You're talking about Einstein. You don't know anything about time anymore, right? You've been traveling.
All right, so let me wrap this up this way. We aren't finished. But I will be here next week, and I will work on finishing this. So we'll keep at this. Meanwhile, just think of in terms of between now and the end of the week, what does it mean to think critically, and what does it mean to be an argument or to have an argument, or to what is an argument, and what is the effect of rhetoric? What is the effect of rhetoric and reasoning?
Lord, thank you for bringing us together today, and thank you for giving us minds. You told us to love you with all our hearts, all our strength, and all our soul, and all our mind. Please help us to use our minds properly, Lord, not just to reason with other people, but also to know you. When we bring others to Christ, and enjoy them and you in heaven forever. In Christ's name, amen.
Amen.